Welcome to the Hot Lava Podcast. Kevin Acey, Padres beat writer for the Union Tribune, joined, as always, the last couple seasons here by Ryan Finley, my boss, sports editor of the Union Tribune. We're doing an off-season slash preseason podcast, as we do from time to time, especially when events merit it. And then, look, there hasn't been anything or there hasn't been much going on with the Padres baseball-wise. Usually at this point, we're 2 weeks before spring training, and I would be just like my head like in the motor of the roster, just kind of figuring out what I'm going to write about, what's going on with the baseball team. And that's not how I've been spending my time. Ryan, we do have a lot to talk about. Where would you like to start?
I'd like to start by talking about the lawsuit that's currently being waged in Tyler, Texas, between Sheil Seidler and two members of the Seidler Family Trust, the Seidler Family Trustees. Kevin, you've been on this story since Sheil's initial lawsuit was filed on January 6th. We ran a very long, very detailed story in Wednesday's newspaper about everything that's going on. As succinctly as we can, Kevin, let's kind of start in the beginning and take us up to where we are now.
Oh, boy. As succinctly as we can. All right. And as we do on this podcast sometimes to give some behind the scenes, I came back from, I think it was 3 weeks of just almost entirely out of touch. I had taken a day or two to sort of look into this story in the middle of December, just before Christmas, and written about how John Seidler, Peter Seidler's older brother, had been named by Matt Seidler, the trustee of the Peter Seidler Trusts, to be the control person of the Padres. That's something that will be voted on by owners next week, by the way. And had heard things about a potential lawsuits, maybe some, but didn't really know. First day back, January 6th, getting ready to dive into with all my notebooks and making some phone calls. The team, Sheil Seidler, files a lawsuit, and she says, in essence, and this is probably the most important thing, she says that Robert Seidler and then currently now Matt Seidler, brothers of Peter Seidler, trustees of the trust, Matt Seidler's the current trustee, have committed fraud, basically. They have breached their fiduciary responsibility to Sheil Seidler as the sole beneficiary. She's the living, you know, as long as she's living, she's the beneficiary of the trust, and then their three children, that they have done some things wrong, and that she has not benefited as she should. There's some fairly vague, I think, allegations in her lawsuit about that she hasn't had enough money. She's had to take out a loan to buy some property, that her and Peter had decided to buy. The brothers made some shady deals in her lawsuit. And that was filed on January 6th. Immediately, the Matt Seidler and the Seidler Trust issue a statement, and then the following day, the 8th, they write a letter and post it to fans and to their partners, denying a lot of these things. Just Monday night, so Tuesday morning, we all kind of wrote about it, and it broke that Matt had, as required by law, filed his response and some accusing Sheil, explaining some of the transactions and why they felt they were legal, basically saying Sheil had no right to bring this lawsuit, does not have a right to contest the trust, and, you know, gave some details about how the trust has paid her and taken care of her and what some of her asks are. Where we're at is it's a she said, they said situation. This could go on into probably will, especially if it goes to a court or goes to a trial, a jury hears this, go into 2026. At the core of this, what I said in the beginning about the lawsuit is that she says that the brothers have done wrong as the trustees and should no longer be trustees, and that anything the trustees have done should be reversed. One of the things they did was make John Seidler the control person or nominate him. He needs to be approved by MLB. That's the heart of this. That nothing else, whether we think Sheil Seidler should be the control person, whether we loved Peter Seidler and it would be a great story, whether we think John Seidler should or should not be, or that you, Ryan Finley, should be control person, none of it matters except that, because the trust clearly spells out that the trustee of the trust determines who the control person of the Padres is. There's not any question about that the trust spells out, the trust that Peter Seidler updated at least seven times, that We have seen that he stated in 2021, the trustee of the trust, of which Matt Seidler is now the trustee, he was named after Robert and before John could be successor trustees, that Matt Seidler gets to pick who the control person is. So
Right. Well, let's take a step back here, because we've used words like family trust, trustee, control person. These are all sort of highly legal, very technical terms. But I think for especially some of our listeners who may not be waist deep in this the way you've been for the last month, or even sort of ankle deep in it the way I've been for the last month, let's be clear. The Padres were not owned by Peter Seidler in the way that Ray Kroc, John Moores, et cetera, owned the Padres.
The way that Steve Cohen owns 95% of the Mets, or the Ilitch family owns 100% of the Tigers, or John Middleton owns, I believe, 51% or something, a majority of the Phillies, or so on and so on.
Right. Peter Seidler was the team's control person because the Seidler Family Trust owns the largest percentage of the Padres.
A plurality. They have the biggest portion that anyone has. Or I shouldn't say they. Peter Seidler Trust. Peter Seidler. And now Sheil Seidler and her children are beneficial owners.
Right.
So they own. We can talk about that. But yes, Ryan, go on. Right. 24% is what Peter Seidler owned of the Padres.
Right. And so while Sheil Seidler and the Seidler's children, with Peter Seidler gone, now own 24% of the Padres, making them the largest shareholders of the Padres.
Just to be clear, the trust owns 24%.
The trust owns 24%.
Beneficial owners, let's say the Padres were to pay out dividends to their owners, okay, which they have not, is my understanding from several people, she would get that money.
Right. Right.
Being a beneficial owner does not necessarily come with any other rights in terms of say so with the team.
Right. Just because you are the beneficial owner does not mean you get to run the team. In fact, the way the Seidler Family Trust was set up and what Peter Seidler, according to our reporting, signed off on as recently as 2021 when he last updated his will, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Was that when he died, the trustee would decide who got to be the control person, regardless of what person.
Note mm-hmm. that, and this is from several people, and when I say several people, mm-hmm. Major League Baseball and Padres and other people around the league, without a doubt, Major League Baseball doesn't mandate, but it has a strong preference, mm-hmm. suggestion / demand mm-hmm. that when a trust is the largest shareholder of a team, mm-hmm. the trustee and the control person are the same person.
So John Seidler, when voted in, he's going to be voted in next week
as the Padres
control person. If he is voted in,
yes,
he will then be named trustee of the family trust.
Which was also in line with what Peter Seidler, who named his brother Robert, when Robert stepped aside, if that were going to happen, which it did in May, Matt. And then if Matt were ever to step aside, it would be John. Look, the fact is, Robert didn't want to run the Padres. Matt doesn't want to run the Padres. I don't know really that John was standing up going, hey, it's me. But right. He will run the Padres and he wants to, for lack of a better term. We haven't talked to him. Never met the man. As far as I recall, never met the man. Right. But the fact is they are doing what they agreed to do mm-hmm. as spelled out in their brother's trust.
Right. Sheil Seidler is not contesting Peter Seidler's will, or she's not contesting the trust's handling of this necessarily. She is saying that the trustee has defrauded her. And as such, nothing the trustee does should be allowed to take place, including naming John Seidler.
In essence, though, it is interesting that then a great portion of her complaint mm-hmm. laid out reasons she should be the trust or right. she should be the control person. And that, and so that's really interesting. It's kind of laying the groundwork for when either she's named trustee or someone the court designates as an independent trustee, that she would then be the control person. Which
and that gets
will have
us
its
to
own hurdles with Major League Baseball, right. But could happen. I mean, okay, but yes, she is saying that the reason this all is not okay is they have not acted in her best interest.
Right. Right. And that brings us to what was the thrust of the story that ran in Wednesday's Union Tribune, but has been online since Monday morning.
So again, right. That was the purpose of that story. Not necessarily to litigate the lawsuit or even really get too deep into the real hardcore accusations of the lawsuit, which are the mishandling, not acting in Shiel's best interest are her allegations. But she claimed in that lawsuit that she had been Peter's partner, that she had been intimately involved. That's my word, intimately. But I mean, that was the best word, because that's what she said she was. She was involved interfacing, her word, with agents, attending owners meetings, talking with Peter in between, owners meetings about what baseball was doing, what was best for the Padres, basically insinuating that she was involved in the signing of free agents and trades and hirings and firings. And so that was fascinating, especially my role as covering the Padres, right? Mm-hmm. That was not something I had ever heard. Had I heard the opposite? I guess that would be the proper way to put it. Mm-hmm. I'd heard the opposite. She was not involved. And also that she wasn't interested. But that wasn't like reporting. That was just kind of what I knew from my conversations with Peter and other people over the years. So I said, I better sit down and find out if this is true, right? Mm-hmm. And in the course of that reporting, which was what, 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks?
A lot of phone calls back and forth between us. Yes. During that time.
And I believe the final count was 17 people. And 15 is when I sent an email to Shiel Seidler asking for clarifications. And I talked to a few people after that. I know it wasn't 20 people. So that I talked to, and of those, we're talking about the vast, vast majority of people not affiliated with the trust. As a matter of fact, John Seidler, Matt Seidler, Robert Seidler, requests to talk to them were denied. The vast majority were not employed by the Padres. In fact, there was no A.J. Preller wouldn't talk. Eric Grubner wouldn't talk. And really, Shiel Seidler, to her credit, was the only person to go on record. Now, she'd already been on record in the lawsuit, right? At the time the story posted, Matt Seidler had not responded. And so my reporting, bottom line, was this was a shock. The contentions she made in her lawsuit were a shock to virtually everyone. And even the people that said, that there were a few people. And look, no one has ever ruled out that her children wouldn't run the team at some point, or that one of them wouldn't be control person.
Could still happen. Yeah.
And in fact, when the trust allows for when they are 40 years old, for them to become co-trustees of their, I don't know exactly how this works, but then how to co-trustees of their own trusts, right? Mm-hmm. Because a trust is a living thing that keeps sort of evolving as people die, right? There's going to be new trustees, all sorts of things will happen. But I think importantly is not allowed for. Shiel Seidler was not named one of the trustees, and was named actually that she could not be a trustee. So that's I think an important distinction. But it was very to me, and I think it's me as the person trying to tell the story of this team, interesting that a lot of people in a position to know, five people very much in a position to know about the running of the Padres over the past 12 plus years, just they never had any inkling that Shiel Seidler was a confidant or a partner on a meaningful level with Peter Seidler. And when I say on a meaningful level, I mean meaningful level in terms of having sway in any decisions made about the Padres.
Right. And I think that the thrust of your story is people close to the Padres weren't surprised necessarily that she filed this lawsuit. They could see this coming a few months out, right? They were surprised by her contention within the lawsuit that she's the most qualified person to run the team, because she had been advising Peter on how to run the Padres for, she says, a decade in her filing.
That's very important, Ryan, because guess what? The story was also not about her not being qualified to be the control person. That's not my place, right? No. Just, I don't think it's anyone's place. Just like I don't think it's anyone's place to say John Seidler is not right. We didn't really get into that. I talked about some of John's qualifications, some of her qualifications in the story, but very briefly on both cases, the story was not about that. And the fact that she wasn't Peter's confidant, or allegedly, or whatever term, you know, wasn't, doesn't mean she shouldn't be control person or whatever. It's just that what she was saying is not something, not only that I couldn't verify, and I asked her to help me verify that, mm-hmm. that really it's what she's saying and that she says that Peter said mm-hmm. against what a lot of other people intimately involved in the running of the Padres over the past 12 years at some point, mm-hmm. A couple of them at least familiar currently what's happening. Obviously, Peter's been dead since November of 2023, are absolutely say that that's just not what she says is just not the case.
Right, right, right. And, you know, I think that that's sort of the important part when we're talking about this very complicated lawsuit. Her claim is twofold. Number one, the trustees have defrauded her and as such should not be the trustees anymore. Number two, if you're looking for a good trustee, Sheila Seidler makes the argument within her claim that she, who had essentially helped run the Padres with her husband, Peter, would be the ideal person to run the Padres once those guys are no longer trusted.
Yes. And okay. And mm-hmm. anyone can have an opinion on that. But the thrust of the story was about, she said this, here's what other people in the know. And I want to point out something that I'm not sure. There's a couple things that I'm not sure that people have grasped over the years. And I always look at myself and go, did I not make this clear enough? And this is one that I thought that I did over my time when I took when I got on the beat in 2018. Of course, as a columnist before that, I had actually grown close to Ron Fowler and to Peter in terms of at least in a professional way. And Peter Seidler was not all that involved in the day-to-day running of the team. He had a say. I'm not saying he wasn't involved. But I can tell you from personal experience, and then also from talking with other people, several other people over the years, Peter was not intimately involved in the running of the Padres until shortly before he took over in November of 2020. Right. So there was that. So then some of the contentions that she made were further refuted mm-hmm. that she had been involved for a decade and plus in an intimate way.
Right, because Peter Seidler, based on your reporting, was not involved in an intimate way for a decade.
And I can tell you, and it's been very clear in case this is the first time you're ever listening to me, I revered Peter Seidler. Mm-hmm. Right. I did. I revered Ron Fowler. These are two men who, in similar and different ways, highly successful and good men, in my opinion. But I can tell you, my first couple years basically three full seasons before Peter was the control person, there would be things I talked to Peter about, and I wasn't involved in the running of the team, but there would be things I would talk to Peter about that I was more aware of than Peter was.
Okay, right.
And so that's just me giving anecdotal evidence of why I would then also find credence in the claims of numerous sources about the same thing.
Sure. Can we do a Kevin Acey question time here? I want to fire a couple questions at you that I've heard from some of our readers, that you may have heard from some of our readers. And I think one of the beauties of this format is we can sort of pull the curtain back on our process a little bit, talk a little bit about this story. Kevin, so many people in your story were quoted anonymously. I know as sports editor, that's something that we take very seriously, that we do only after careful consideration. Why did they need to be quoted anonymously? And is there anything to Sheila Seidler's claim that it's really hard to respond to anonymous criticism?
Yes, I do. I want to defend her first, or defend anyone that is put in that position first. But that also can be a little bit of a cop-out, right?
Sure.
Because I had specific things and I purposely asked specific things, specific ways of her representatives, different people in her camp, to give them an opportunity to refute what I was saying. I wasn't being vague with my questions. And so then at some point, if there's things that are specific, it really doesn't matter whether they're anonymous, because if they were specific and false, you could refute them.
Right.
Or, you know, affirm them if you want it. Right. But I do wanted to say that, yeah, there's some validity in that. There generally always is, but it also can be a bit of a cop out. Sure. Why? Well, some people, and there were a couple people that offered to give quotes and mm-hmm. then didn't on the advice of counsel.
They don't want to be dragged into it.
Okay. There are some prominent people around the country that don't want to be dragged into it. That maybe don't want to take public sides, but felt compelled to tell the truth, concerned maybe about Peter's legacy, concerned about the Padres. So, you know, the good of Major League Baseball, whatever it was, their motivation was. And some of them said, look, I don't talk about this usually, but I will. And want to, and I have in my mind right now, protect Peter's legacy. Another, you know, because they love Peter. You know, some of the people I've known for years, and I just know that, you know, they're honorable people. Other people I had to beg to talk. Some worked for the Padres, not authorized to talk. Some worked for agencies, not authorized to talk. There was a MLB executive, not authorized to talk publicly. So that was the conditions. I had to share some of them with you. Always have to justify it. And you gave this as good a read as and when I say that, that should be reads plural. The editor of the paper and a lawyer for the Union Tribune. This was John Schlegel, I believe, probably three other people. I don't know. You're the boss. But yes, anonymous sources we need, and especially the volume. But for me personally, when you get an anonymous source, especially maybe it's not someone you're familiar with or there might be a motive behind something, you need to make sure that everybody's stories line up, and they did. And look, there's drama always going on in this world. And there's it stands to reason. There's drama going on with the Padres. And over the years, some different people have left and maybe haven't left in good, you know, stead, and maybe they don't like some people there now or vice versa. And I'm just going to tell you that one of the things that makes you as a journalist, a reporter, someone trying to get to the truth, when you have people that are not on the same side of the aisle, agreeing basically independently of each other without prompting, saying the same thing, you can believe that.
Kevin, you talked to dozens of people spread across the country who may have once worked for the Padres. Is this your way of telling me that you're only quoting former hitting coaches?
Got it? Yes. I try to make a rule of never saying who I didn't talk to.
I didn't talk to the 13 hitting coaches they've had in 12 years. Next question on this, and I think that this is where a lot of our readers and a lot of our listeners, this is the question they want answered. Is this why they're not spending money?
Okay. Short answer, no. Longer answer, as many answers need to be layered and have context, is we can't rule out that this has been a part of it for, or that the reticence early on, and then we don't know what were the chips. Like early on, were they we need to be in a holding pattern, and then a guy they wanted to sign went somewhere else, or a trade they wanted to make fell through or something. That I don't know. I can't tell you this has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with it. What I can tell you is that it wasn't going to be a big offseason, in terms of big spending anyway.
Right.
And I think that anyone, honestly, who was paying attention to what they've done and what they've said would have known that.
Eric Grubner said 2 years ago this month that going forward, that sort of spending was not sustainable. And that going forward, they would essentially need to develop their own prospects and turn them into stars. And we see that the Padres did a little bit of that last year with Jackson Merrill. They have a couple of players coming up in Leo DeVries and in Ethan Salas, who they think can be cornerstones of the franchise going forward. But this is something that even when Peter Seidler, because I want to be very clear about this while I've got you here, when Peter Seidler was alive, the plan was always to throttle down the $300 million contracts once they got to a certain, correct?
What I can tell you is that, and I've looked back, and I can't find a time that I quoted him. I have had some, I'm 54 years old, going on 55, and I'm not great. I may have lost some recordings. There also were many off the record and background conversations with Peter. And what I can promise you beyond a shadow of a doubt, that on multiple occasions, he told me, and he may have told others, that, and I want to make this clear, Peter was purposely and expertly vague on this sort of thing. Okay. Right. So he never flat out said, you know, I'm not going to spend $300 million every year. No, he did tell me he did not intend to be in a top five payroll for perpetuity. Okay. And that he used words like experiment. It's a risk. We're trying to find out what we can do. The art of the possible, right? Everyone's familiar with that phrase from him. And it was to see what a market like San Diego, which means fans, you know, attendance, sponsors, what can it support? All right. We're going in. We want exciting players that are going to help us win. Those are the two things that are going to draw in fans and then get us to the goal of a championship and his parade, whether on land or water, right? Like, and so that was, but it's important to note that when Eric Grubner, who the CEO, aware of virtually everything going on and aware of a business plan long-term in January of 2023. So that's before the big year. That's before the number three payroll. That's the year of that, right? 2 weeks before spring training starts. He's talking and they're about to have this payroll with all the guys, Nelson Cruz, Matt Carpenter, just signed Xander, about to sign Manny Machado and Jake Cronenworth, you know, two extensions, had just signed Musgrove, Darvish. We will not keep doing this. And so that's when now when it is talked about that, oh, it's the current ownership. It's Eric Kutsenda, the control person, longtime partner of Peter's, who took over as control person. It's the Seidler brothers that are orchestrating this kind of like a pullback, almost a like a fire sale feeling, right?
A bait and switch. Yeah.
Right. It's like, no, that's that I can tell you, that's just not the case. What the extent and how this all plays together, like I don't know who would know, like to be able to definitively say it has nothing to do with it, but it just doesn't. I mean, I'm very, very, very comfortable saying that.
Sure. What are the possible outcomes here? I mean, I can think of three things, but let's lay this out. What are the things that can come of this lawsuit being resolved one way or the other?
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, let's start with the biggie that you can't rule out, that it would get to, you know, there's this lack of agreement and the franchise gets sold. That's not something that's being talked about at all right now that I know of. Look, is this something that I heard at the winter meetings? Is it something that some people have speculated on? People like smart people in the know have speculated on, but no one with the team, and there's no reason to think they would right now. But look, unfortunately, that's something I'm going to have on my radar from now until, I guess, you know, the end of time. Or Sheil Seidler and the family could come to some sort of agreement. Look, she loses her lawsuit. As far as I know, then things just go back to what they were, right? Like John Seidler is the trustee and who, you know, as we mentioned earlier in the podcast, that when he becomes control person, he'll become trustee around that time. And so, yeah, I guess that's a possibility, but I'm not sure like where it is that you want to go in terms of that, but in taking that and combining it with your previous question and about the payroll and all that stuff, I don't know that it has a real, unless the team gets sold and somebody like Steve Cohen buys the team and then goes, hey, these contracts that aren't working out, let's say they're not, right? Like, we're just going to take them off, you know, don't worry about it. And we're going to spend $400 million on this team. Maybe right. That's an outcome.
Right. Well, to me, that's the question. You know, Jeff Sanders wrote something, I think it was two Sundays ago for us, talking about the fact that these sorts of disputes are actually fairly common, or at least recently there are examples.
They're not unheard of.
Right. Including one involving the San Diego. Oh my. Oh, can we edit that in post?
The former
Los Angeles Chargers. You know, Dean Spanos had to buy out his sister after his sister sued Dean Spanos. Right.
Actually, some other really rich guy bought 27%. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes, that's correct. You know, that's the thing, right? Is that these things happen. Sometimes you're able to either buy out or somehow settle with the aggrieved party. Sometimes you decide that the best way to settle all this is to sell the team and split the profit, right? And I mean, I think that we can't rule that out as a very real possibility if this continues on down the path.
Sure. I mean, at some point, look, the Seidler family is a very private family. Like it's one of the sort of sad things. I mean, just looking as an outsider, right? Like it's sort of sad that this family, this storied family, the O'Malley Seidler family, and very private, in fact, is being just pilloried and dragged through, right? Like I'm not defending them or anything. I'm not anything, right? I'm like saying, like, they're a very private family and maybe this won't be worth it. That's just me speculating. Like, right. You know, you're right. Can't rule that out. But at this point, and I will tell you this, John Seidler, according to multiple people, including some people that don't have just any skin in this game at all, was at 60 games last year.
Okay.
And has been to dozens of games every year for a while, right? Mm-hmm. I don't have attendance logs. And by the way, by multiple accounts, far more games than Shiel Seidler.
Mm-hmm.
That's neither here nor there in who's qualified to run the team, but the guy has been interested in the Padres and has a small ownership stake in them. So it's not like it's out of nowhere. And the idea, because I'll just bring this up because I've been asked it a bit, but like, you know, could you pick him out of a lineup? Nope. Well, I mean, I can now. But could I have before? No, I don't think so, though. I do remember seeing Peter's brothers before, but over the last 8 years. But, you know, and what about how, you know, Shiel was there with the kids a lot this year? Okay. Yeah. But you know what Shiel Seidler looks like, and she was down on the field. And you don't know what John Seidler looked like, and he might have been sitting next to you.
Right. I mean, when somebody said John Seidler went to 60 games, Kevin, did you go, oh, that's adorable, only 60 games? Somebody who goes to 162 and this year went to 100 and – how many did you go to this year? 170, something like
that? 150, not counting spring training, of course, because those aren't games. Oh, no, wait. And then the postseason. So yeah. I guess 157. Yeah.
Wow. Again, as we wrap this up here, I think that it bears repeating, especially in this format, where you and I can talk about the process and talk about everything else. We don't come upon stories like this. I'll think back to the story you wrote about the growing issues between Bob Melvin and AJ Preller, story you wrote about Manny Machado and the clubhouse at the end of the 2023 season. These are stories we go about in a very serious, very fastidious way. And it's weeks and weeks, and in your case, in this story, Kevin, hundreds of hours spent putting together a story. And going back to both sides and saying, hey, they have said this, what's your response? Hey, they have said that, what's your response? There's a real care that we take in the newspaper profession to make sure that these stories are done the right way. And, you know, I don't know how anybody could read the story that you wrote on Wednesday's paper and not look at it as something that was the product of hundreds of hours.
Well, I appreciate that because whether you liked it or didn't or whatever. Yeah, I was just telling a story. That's all. I do want to circle back if we could on the payroll thing. I'm not sure that we had talked about this, but the one question that you brought up about why are they here? And let's just talk about like the reality of where they're at, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they're going to have to subtract. They're going to trade Dylan Cease. That's my feeling. They're going to trade Dylan Cease or, Michael King. They don't want to, but like, I they've been trying and they have to subtract in order to add. But about where they are right now, around $200 million is where they're going to be. And I wrote something last Saturday, I think it was in Sunday's paper, about how that's sort of counter to sort of the idea that they're going to be somewhere around 10th in payroll. That's 10 out of 30 teams and be at the level they're at runs counter to the idea that they're kind of like not in it to win it. Right. And I'm not necessarily saying they're a playoff team. I want to see what it is that they do, but it's only January and I want to see what they do. They need a left fielder. They did get a catcher this week. I think their catching situation, they're going to go in competition. They do need another starting pitcher. I think they got a pretty loaded bullpen, but they'll probably add a reliever. So, you know, they might trade Robert Suarez. But the idea that they're not in it to win it when they have a $200 million payroll, Fernando Tatis Jr., Manny Machado, at least one of the two pitchers among King and Cease, Yu Darvish, you have a really good bullpen, I think. You have Jackson Merrill. You have committed all this money. Now, who committed it? Well, Peter Seidler, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Who's paying it now?
Right.
These guys, the people running the team now. And so like, it's not anyone's fault that maybe some of the guys who are going to make up a huge portion of this $200 million haven't lived up to what they should. Because like, let's just be honest, like if Jake Cronenworth and Xander Bogaerts, if Jake Cronenworth was 2020 Jake Cronenworth now, right, in terms of had kept up that sort of production, and Xander Bogaerts was what he had been for a decade with the Red Sox, I think the feeling about the team would be a lot better, right?
Yeah.
That was money well spent. And okay, hey, so we're going to have Randall Grichuk is our left fielder in a platoon with somebody and or some $4 million left fielder.
We're going to be able to do this. Right. Yeah.
Our infield is made up of all stars. You know, the top five in the batting order, it doesn't get any better than that. Well, that's not like John Seidler or Matt Seidler or Eric Cassenda's fault that's not the case. But they were never going to have a $250 million payroll. It just, that doesn't pencil out for them. Now, we can be mad about that. When I say we, fans, the media can question it. Like, I don't know how you feel about that, but like, that's where we could go to, heck yeah. And I've made this argument. I think the Dodgers are right. People are jealous of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That doesn't mean people don't have some valid concerns about the unfairness, quote unquote, of this whole thing and the Dodgers and their TV money and their ownership and all and their structure of their contracts. But the fact is, if your team had unlimited money, you'd be happy as heck.
I'll go back to Kevin. I think the first time you and I met in this format to host a Hot Lava podcast together was just about 2 years ago, February. So almost 2 years ago, you said on that first episode, because I'm sure we were talking about your conversation with Kitsenda, or not Kitsenda, with Grubner about payroll. You said then something that you've said on this podcast once a month since, which is if you're superstars, play like superstars. If the guys who you're paying like superstars deliver, there aren't that many holes on this team. And I think that that's where we're at heading into spring training here. If Xander Bogaerts hits, if Jake Cronenworth hits, you can patch it in left field. You can go get a starting pitcher on the cheap and hope that he delivers for you. And if these guys continue to hit and if they win, I still think that no matter what the ownership situation is, if they need a player, if they need two players and it's August, they'll do what competing teams do, I think. You know, I can't imagine. This is not the movie Major League. You know, they're not going to move to Vegas. They're not trying to tank to move to Vegas. This is a team with $200 million to spend and superstars on their roster who frankly just need to play better.
Yes. In this point you're making, I'll say amen. Obviously, and you're not saying this, it's not as simple as that, but yes. Yeah. Let's not lose sight of that. I'll try to say it at least once a month going forward, or maybe I'll say Padres fans should be very happy if I say, see, I told you if superstars play like superstars, then, you know, look, if Jake Cronenworth was had an OPS of 750, let's say, and Xander Bogaerts was hitting 300 like he did for 10 years. You put Brandon Lockridge and somebody else out in left field and you still have a pretty good team. If also Fernando Tatis Jr. in right and Jackson Merrill in center are doing what they're have done in the past. You got Manny Machado able to carry on. Don't get me started on what you're going to be looking at in this team in 2, 3, 4 years in terms of aged guys making $70 million between them. But for now, this is a team that is capable if those guys play. That is not to take the, hey, AJ Preller's got to do pretty much just as well as he did last year. By the way, $100 million less last year than the year before. Right. And which one of those years did they make the playoffs?
Right.
I'm not saying, oh, that proves they're going to make the playoffs again, or we shouldn't be holding their feet to the fire. I'm saying those are the facts of what happened in recent history.
Right, 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 right. Not to say that cutting always leads to better baseball.
Right.
But spending money smart leads to better baseball. And the Padres, I think, made a couple great signings last year that have paid off. Jerickson Profar is a very rich man today because of what he was able to do with the Padres last year. He joined Seth Lugo and Michael Wacha as guys who should send flowers to AJ Preller every year saying, thank you because I'm a 50 millionaire, right?
Yeah, 50.
You know, but really, I mean, that's how this is going to be. And I think that when, you know, I think fans have a tendency to maybe catastrophize a little bit. As somebody who grew up in this market, watching Padre baseball.
Yeah, I think you are. I think you're qualified to say that. Sure.
I get it. I think people are always waiting for the other shoe to drop. But you've said it and you wrote it on Sunday. Just because this has been a franchise that's been largely irrelevant, except for the name Tony Gwynn, for 30 of the last 40 years, that has no bearing on what they're doing in the year 2020.
Both good and bad. It doesn't mean we should be satisfied with what they're doing now.
Right?
Like, because it hasn't resulted in any championship yet, right?
Right.
Because it hasn't resulted in any signings yet. Because what are you doing? What have you done for me lately? So both ways, and it also just doesn't mean it's going to be bad forever. Though I absolutely understand the thinking when, all you had to do was win one of two games in the division series to the team that ended up winning. And so many people in baseball thought that, Padres were actually the team best positioned. And then you go into the offseason and this happens with the lawsuit. And I get it. I get it. People like yourself, Ryan, if we were going to, been here for a long, long, long time. Because before you became Sports Editor of the Union Tribune, I mean, where'd you go? Uni.
Go Dons.
Okay, gosh, I'm glad I didn't get that wrong.
Thank God you didn't say Saints. Yes.
You grew up and you grew up as a rabid Padres fans, Padres fan. So, yeah. And you're constantly, for people that don't listen to the Hot Lava podcast a lot, dropping obscure mentions about this team that prove your credentials of guys that I have to go, yeah, I think I've heard of that guy. And you're giving me his stats from 1992.
What name came up last week? Was it Reimer Liriano?
Yeah, you did. You pulled that one out on me.
I was like, he wore number 7. What was his name? Yeah. It's funny. Kevin, I think that we should stop it here. Look, there's a ton going on here in the next week, both in the Union Tribune for Kevin Acey and with the Padres personally, or for Kevin Acey personally and with the Padres. You've got FanFest coming up on Saturday. You've got owners meetings next week. And then, what is it? February the 12th?
Yep.
Pitchers and catchers report to Peoria. Kevin, I'm sure that we will talk at some point as news merits between now and then. Otherwise, that'll do it for this episode of the Hot Lava Podcast. Thank you, Kevin, for taking the time to talk through this story. It's complicated, but I appreciate your insight and your work so, so much. For Kevin Acey, I'm Ryan Finley. We'll see you next time.